This war is real. Fighting is everything. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Tempt not the righteous man to draw his sword. Conviction, righteousness, ruthlessness. To understand tolerance, you have to understand the line of intolerance. War is the teacher, soldiers are the students. They become the bards of war.
Good morning, patriots. And again, for those of you that were here earlier, hello again. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of sometimes nice to sit back and watch chat a little bit. I was watching a lot of it on this morning over on YouTube, since we're both on YouTube and Podbean right now. And I do it pretty frequently. And it's interesting to see the comments. And it's not calling anybody out, but the number of people that have a perception that this is going to be fixed for them. I think every one of us at one point needs to take a step back and realize that our country is not going to be fixed for us. It was never designed that way. The country was, in principle, a country of we the people. President Trump, in my opinion, it does not matter what he does going forward. He has accomplished his mission, and that mission was to give us back the focus of what our true role was in this nation, which was a nation of patriots that need to defend and protect this country through the process of standing up, being truthful, defying evil, being tight and in alignment with God, and not deviating from the line of truth. That all that principle is centered on the most powerful concept in our Constitution, in our Bill of Rights, which is the First Amendment. The process of engagement, the process of communicating, the process of persuading those to awaken, to guiding them from darkness, has never been easy. It was the principle of what our founding fathers did. And it is the foundation that will make this country great, or in which we will fail. And when we sit back and we expect one man, one person, or a group of people like the military to always fix it, and always looking to that as some heroic moment, we've quite literally failed ourselves. And we failed this nation in the process. It's easy to look at the big issue and go, well, what about this? And why aren't they doing this? And I don't know. Because I'll tell you what, it's just like people telling me why we lost this election, what President Trump did or didn't do. I don't hear President Trump saying it. I know that there's nobody that's saying that has had what's called a Yankee white clearance, which is his clearance level. I know that when I hear people observing the military and saying what they are or aren't doing, no one saying that is inside that classified circle of TS, TSSCI, and above. So everybody that's out there doing that, and very effectively, has just given up. Because what they have done is they've turned and expected someone else to fix it for them. That attitude, whether you people like to hear it or not, originates from a socialist infection in this nation. Our founding fathers were not of an origin where people were expecting a handout and the government to fix things for them. And hence the reason of reading these amazing papers, the Federalist Papers, is an insight of how passionate and how important these debates were, not just to our founding fathers, but to the entire colonialist, all population as a whole. These papers run on the average of about 3 to 4 pages each. Every day I read them, and I read well, but every day I'm challenged by words that they use. These papers were published in newspapers across the state of New York. That means they were available for everybody to read. And yet I know today that there's not one publication that would publish these, not because of their bias, but because no one would read them. That part is probably the most awakening and startling reality as we go through this, is that people would not take the time to sit and read these arguments and process these arguments. And yet, the colonists did. When we, Thomas Paine's book, Common Sense, was a pamphlet. It's about 30 some odd pages. And it's a very well-crafted argument as to what our government should look like, published in January of 1776. Ask yourself if you read it, and if you haven't, why? It will take time. It takes reading. But imagine it this. In the colonial period, that pamphlet saw circulation. Some estimates say as high as 700,000 copies. That's a New York Times bestseller today. This is truly a moment where we have to reflect on what we truly want in this world. It's not about someone fixing it for us, because, quite frankly, we might as well have a king. And then you better hope that it's a benevolent one. But this is exactly where the left is. And it's, if we're going to accept that argument that someone else is going to fix it for us, I'm not sure we've stepped too so far away from where the left is. We're trying to reestablish the principles of what this country was built upon. And that's liberty, the right to choose, and each person being sovereign as given by God. But that doesn't come without huge responsibility. As Ben Franklin said, you have a republic, good luck keeping it. And sadly, he understood something in that statement that most people don't care that much to want to keep it. I would hope that he was wrong. And I, to this day, hope that he's wrong. But that's going to require that people stand up, buck up, and start accepting that this was never going to be some quick fix that was never going to be solved by one man or a group of military that we outsource our freedom to all the time. Our freedom is an individual responsibility. And if there's one theme that I hope everybody gets in these Federalist Papers, is that every single person in the colony at the end of the Revolutionary War was very cognizant of the fact that their security was each of them part, they were each part of the security of the nation. That has to return for this country for us to wake up. And the principal part of the digital army was to awaken to that, not to be having fun trolling on Twitter, but to realize that every single person in this nation that took that oath is now part of the defense of the nation. And that this war is a war of information and a war of influence and a war of perception of truth. And that centers on the two issues that I talk about all the time, knowledge and faith. So today we're going to jump into Federalist Paper number 8. And for those that are new, to put this in some context, the Federalist Papers, commonly referred to as the Federalist Papers, is a series of 85 essays written by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison between October 1787 and May 1788. The essays were published anonymously under the pen name Publius in various New York State newspapers at the time. The Federalist Papers were written and published to urge New Yorkers to ratify the proposed United States Constitution, which was drafted in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. In lobbying for the adoption of the Constitution over the existing Articles of Confederation, the essays explain particular provisions of the Constitution in detail. For this reason, and because Hamilton and Madison were each members of the Continental Convention, the Federalist Papers are often used today to help interpret the intentions of those drafting the Constitution. And it wasn't until the publication by Jacob Gideon in 1818, in which he worked and made and had corrections provided by Madison, that we actually learned the authors' names. Up until that point, the Federalist Papers were published under anonymous. So today's paper, number 8, is written by Alexander Hamilton and was published on Tuesday, November 20th, 1787, in what the publication was known as the New York Packet. The title of Federalist number 8 is the consequences of hostilities between states, and it's essentially what would happen if states go to war between each other. Again, keep in mind that these Federalist papers, especially in these early ones, are all arguing for a unified nation, one nation under a federal framework, united and not divided, as opposed to a European model that was being pushed and likely being influenced by European agents, in particular members of the Crown and agents from Spain and France, who saw as a major threat a United States was a major concern for them, not just militarily, but economically. And those two issues, as they were then, are today the same. Let's begin. To the people of the state of New York, assuming it is therefore an established truth that the several states, in case of disunion or such combinations of them as might happen to be found out of the wreck of the General Confederacy, would be subject to those vicissitudes of peace and war, of friendship and enmity with each other, which have fallen to the lot of neighboring nations, not united under one government, let us enter into a concise detail of some of the consequences that would attend such a situation. War between the states in the first period of their separate existence would be accompanied with such great distress than it commonly is in those countries where regular military establishments have long obtained. This disciplined armies always kept on foot on the continent of Europe, though they bear a malignant aspect to liberty and economy, have, notwithstanding, been productive of the single advantage of rendering sudden conquests impractical and of preventing that rapid dissolution which used to mark the progress of war prior to their introduction. The art of fortification has contributed to the same ends. The nations of Europe have encircled with chains of fortified places which mutually obstruct invasion. Campaigns are wasted in reducing two or three frontier garrisons to gain admittance into an enemy's country. Similar impediments occur at every step to exhaust the strength and delay the progress of an invader. Formerly, an invading army would penetrate into the heart of a neighboring country almost as soon as intelligence of its approach could be received. But now, a comparatively small force of disciplined troops acting on the defensive with the aid of posts is able to impede and finally to frustrate the enterprise of one much more considerable. The history of war is that quarter of the globe is no longer a history of nations subdued by empires overturned, but of towns taken and retaken, of battles that decide nothing and of retreats more beneficial than victories, of more effort and little acquisition. In this country, the scene would be altogether reversed. The jealousy of military establishment would postpone them as long as possible. The want of fortifications leaving the frontiers of one state open to another would facilitate inroads. The populous states would, with little difficulty, overrun their populous neighbors. Conquest would be as easy to be made as difficult to be retained. War, therefore, would be a desolatory and predatory in nature. Plunder and devastation ever marched in the train of irregulars. The calamities of individuals would make the principal figure in the events which would characterize our military exploits. Patriots, one important part about this part of this essay is the reality that our founding fathers were very cognizant of the fact that war, a breakout of war, in particular civil war between states, was a very real consequence. And it was a very real devastating consequence at that. Their arguments, their influence, their discussions were very real into the consequences of what would happen if they could not develop a union. They realized that if states were to break apart, that by just their nature alone, the people would seek to dominate one another. They're very cognizant of how human nature works. And the other great thing about our founding fathers is not only were they wise in the philosophies and understanding of human, of the humankind, but they were also wise into the ways of war, and they carried an extremely powerful historical consciousness of what had gone on in the past. It allowed them to look at the present and understand very clearly what the risks are as they move forward. We'll continue. This picture is not too highly wrought, though, I confess. It would not long remain a just one. Safety from external danger is the most powerful director of national conduct. Even the ardent love of liberty will, after a time, give way to its dictates. The violent destruction of life and property incident to war, the continual effort and alarm attendant on the state of continual danger, will compel nations the most attached to liberty to resort for repose and security to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. To be more safe, they are at length become willing to run the risk of becoming less free. Every one of us should take that to heart. 9/11 was an act that allowed for the gateway for all of us to acquiesce and give away the majority of our Constitution's rights through the Patriot Act. And the public did so willingly for these words, to be more safe. They at length become willing to run the risk of being less free. We'll continue. The institutions chiefly alluded to are standing armies and the correspondent appendages of military establishments. Standing armies, it is said, are not provided against in the new Constitution, and it is therefore inferred that they may exist under it. Their existence, however, from the very terms of the proposition, is at most problematical and uncertain. But standing armies, it may be replied, must inevitably result from a dissolution of the Confederacy. Frequent war and constant apprehension, which requires a state of a constant preparation, will infallibly produce them. The weaker states or confederacies would first have recourse to them to put themselves upon an equality with their most potent neighbors. They would endeavor to supply the inferiority of population and resources by a more regular and effective system of defense, of disciplined troops, and by fortifications. They would, at the same time, be necessitated to strengthen the executive arm of government, in doing which their constitutions would acquire a progressive direction towards monarchy. It is of the nature of war to increase the executive at the expense of the legislative authorities. We have seen these words play out in truth in our nation over the last 50 years. Increasingly, as we have seen the government derailed by a very dark and evilly intended cabal, we have seen the ability of the executive to wage war around the legislative's approval to increase. And even worse, in our modern day, there is a cooperation between the executive and the legislative to wage war. President Trump tried to derail that and has done an incredible job of derailing that process by separating out the legislative and the executive and of removing our presence of war. But war is a narcotic, and once you begin, it becomes an industry. We continue. The expedients which have been mentioned would soon give the states or confederacies that made use of them a superiority over their neighbors. Small states or states of less natural strength, under vigorous governments and with the assistance of disciplined armies, have often triumphed over large states or states of greater natural strength, which have been destitute of these advantages. Neither the pride nor the safety of more important states or confederacies would permit them long to submit to the mortifying and adventitious superiority. They would quickly resort to means similar to those by which it had been effected, to reinstate themselves in their lost preeminence. Thus, we should in a little time see established in every part of this country the same engines of despotism which have been the scourge of the old world. This, at least, would be the natural course of things, and our reasonings will be the more likely to be just in proportion as they are accommodated to this standard. Our founding fathers, patriots, understood very well the consequences of divided countries, divided states, confederacies, the multiple armies that sprinkled all across Europe, and what that led to, which was a constant state of warring and ultimately a constant state of loss of freedom and liberty. They also understood that states themselves were not naturally aligned. They would not naturally fall under the umbrella of a federal architecture. So this was a very fine line in creating a balance between the federal and a sovereign state, knowing that the states had to give away some sovereignty to create the federal state, but in the same time, the federal aspect had to remain, have a small footprint to ensure that states had a measure of their own autonomy and a measure of sovereignty within the boundaries of the Constitution. We continue. These are not vague inferences drawn from supposed or speculative defects in a Constitution, the whole power of which is lodged in the hands of a people or their prospective and representatives and delegates, but they are solid conclusions drawn from the natural and necessary progress of human affairs. It may perhaps be asked by way of objection of this, why did not standing armies spring up out of the contentions which so often distracted the ancient republics of Greece? Different answers, equally satisfactory, may be given to this question. The industrious habits of the people of the present day, absorbed in their pursuit of gain and devoted to the improvements of agriculture and commerce, are incompatible with the conditions of a nation of soldiers, which was the true condition of the people of those republics. The means of revenue, which have been so greatly multiplied by the increase of gold and silver and of the arts of industry and the science of finance, which is the offspring of modern times, concurring with the habits of nations, have produced an entire revolution in the system of war. And we have rendered disciplined armies distinct from the body of citizens, the inseparable companions of frequent hostility. Those words again are the reminder that as the industrialness and might of a nation grows, there is the trap that the military machine itself can become bigger as the economy and an economy into itself. There is a wide difference also between military establishments in a country seldom exposed by its situation to internal invasions, and in one which is often subject to them and always apprehensive of them. The rulers of the former can have a good pretext, if they are even so inclined, to keep on foot armies so numerous, and a must of necessity be maintained in the latter. These armies, being in their first case rarely, if at all, called into activity for interior defense, the people are in no danger of being broken to military subordination. The laws are not accustomed to relaxations in favor of military exigencies. The civil state remains in full vigor, neither corrupted nor confounded with the principle or propensities of the other state. Enjoy that stumble on word there. That's not enough coffee in the morning. The smallness of the army renders the natural strength of the community an overmatch for it, and the citizens, not habituated to the lookup to the military power for protection or to submit to its oppressions, neither love nor fear the soldiery. They view them with a spirit of jealous acquiescence in a necessary evil, and stand ready to resist a power which they suppose may be exerted to the prejudice of their rights. The army under such circumstances may usefully aid the magistrate to suppress a small faction, or an occasional mob, or an insurrection, but it will be unable to enforce encroachments against the united efforts of the great body of people. There's a lot of wisdom in that passage, and though it may seem a rather complicated discussion, at the end of the day, the reality is that the military has an ability to protect a nation. A military equally has an ability to be used against a people. But in the end, as was well understood, a people united is a strength that no military can stop. In a country in this predicament last described, the contrary of all of this happens. The perpetual menacing of danger obliged the government to always be prepared to repel it. Its armies must be numerous enough for instant defense. The continual necessity for their services enhances the importance of the soldier and proportionably degrades the conditions of the citizen. The military state becomes elevated above the civil. The inhabitants of the territories, often theater of war, are unavoidably subjected to frequent infringements on their rights, which serve to weaken their sense of those rights, and by degree, the people are brought to consider the soldiery not only as their protectors, but as their superiors. The transition from this disposition to that of considering them masters is neither remote nor difficult, but it is very difficult to prevail upon a people under such impressions, to make a bold or effectual resistance to usurpation supported by the military power. It's a very treacherous slope that was discussed here. It is the desire to support and revere the military, but equally it is the trap that if revered too much, we, the citizenry, fall as subjects lesser than the military. I think the one thing that we should all keep in mind in this fight, the digital army has now been elevated as a citizen representative of an information war that is on foot and equal to our great military. It allows for a certain balance and the necessity to maintain a republic. The Kingdom of Great Britain falls within the first description, an insular situation and a powerful marine guarding it in a great measure against the possibility of foreign invasion, supersede the necessity of a numerous army within the kingdom, a sufficient force to make head against a sudden descent till the militia could have time to rally and embody, is all that has been deemed requisite. No motive of national policy has demanded, nor would public opinion have tolerated, a large number of troops upon its domestic establishment. There has been, for a long time past, little room for the opposition of the other causes, which have been enumerated as the consequences of internal war. This peculiar felicity of situations has, in great degree, contributed to preserve the liberty with which that country to this day enjoys, in spite of the prevalent venality and corruption. If, on the contrary, Britain has been situated on the continent and had been compelled, as she would have been by that situation, to make her military establishment at home coextensive with those of the other great powers of Europe, she, like them, would in all probability be, at this day, a victim of the absolute power of a single man. T is possible, though not easy, with the people of that island may be enslaved from other causes, but it cannot be by the powers of an army so inconsiderable as that which has been usually kept up within the kingdom. Patriots, it's a very interesting passage because throughout this paper, there's been a couple of subtle references which are critical to remember, and that is the reference to states having the ability to have armies and additionally, states here being part of a national defense through militia. It's something that I think as we move forward will need to be reconsidered as to the role of what the militia looks like, both in terms of an information army and as far as physical defense, not to be used against state by state, but in terms of a national defense at the time of the colonies. State militias were an integral part of the standing defense of the nation, not just one standing army. It's a critical piece as well within understanding the Second Amendment. If we are wise enough to preserve the Union, we may for ages enjoy an advantage similar to that of an insulated situation. Europe is at a great distance from us. Her colonies in our vicinity will be likely to continue too much disproportioned in strength to be able to give us any dangerous annoyance. Extensive military establishments cannot, in this position, be necessary for our security. But if we should be disunited, and the integral parts should either remain separated or, which is most probable, should be thrown together into two or three confederacies, we should be in a short course of time in the predicament of the continual continental powers of Europe. Our liberties would be prey to the means of defending ourselves against the ambitions and jealousy of each other. This is an idea not superficial or futile, but solid and weighty. It deserves the most serious and mature consideration of every prudent and honest man of whatever party. If such men will make a firm and solemn pause and meditate dispassionately on the importance of this interesting idea, if they will contemplate it all in its attitudes and trace to it all its consequences, they will not hesitate to part their trivial objections to a constitution, their rejection of which would in all probability put a final period to the Union. The airy phantoms that flit before the distempered imaginations of some of its adversaries would quickly give place to the more substantial forms of dangers, real, certain, and formidable. And that concludes Federalist Paper number 8. It's a powerful paper in reflecting on the vulnerabilities of our Union, the fact that it is very possible in dissolution or in breaking the Union apart that you end up in a state of perpetual conflict. We've witnessed that in what all it can do in all of its horrors when Yugoslavia broke up after the death of Tito. Through manipulations of foreign powers, we saw an empire break up into its pieces and ultimately led to the War of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is probably one of the greatest horrors in our modern day. I have no doubt that if we fell to such level that we would see the same level of destruction within our own national borders. And so it is upon us, each and every one of us, to fight daily to bring a union, a peaceful resolution, and a bridge between people to awaken them into the purpose of this Constitution and the means and need to stay united and free as people. When we fight that fight, it is the noble fight. It is the fight that is in the honor of our founding fathers. It is a place where we work diligently every day to press for truth, to use cogent arguments to awaken people, to have them see truly what the intent of our Constitution was, what the purpose of the Union was with sovereign states and a small federal, and what that means for each and every individual in terms of liberty and the right to truly live free under the words, "In God we trust." Let's close with a prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for these times that we have in spending a reflective period on the origins of our nation, reading the words of our founding fathers to reflect deeply on the well-considered arguments and considerations of the day that led to the Union and the need to have all states bannered under one flag. Let us stand strong and let us continue to push for truth, to walk that path of love of spirit and that line of unwavering truth in all that we do. Let us be the examples for others to follow. Let us be the light to awaken dark hearts. Let us be the bearer of the eyes to see, ears to hear, and breath to speak. And we say these things in Christ's holy name. Amen. So, Patriots, I wish you a very blessed day. Be back at 9:45 for Political Theology. For those of you on YouTube, I always do a different program, just so you're aware, because of the YouTube censors over there that like to obliterate accounts for small little words. So there is a Political Theology on YouTube, and there is a live stream on Podbean, and you can choose which one you want. Anyway, Patriots, remember, head up, eyes forward, never bow to evil, never relent, always press in. Above all, pray and know that God is with you and He will deliver. Until the next time, out for now. Every night you sing the blues, always wishing that it was you to hold the crown, the one they talk about. Stand in the sun, burning the fire.
looking in when you've already won. You know how it takes, but you throw it away, pushing it out.